In 2011, young people took to the streets in Egypt and Iran and in other Middle Eastern countries. They were pushing for regime change, and in Egypt they succeeded. That movement became known as the Arab Spring, and those protesters successfully used websites like Twitter and YouTube to spread their message. Philip Howard calls this use of social media digital activism, whether it's to overthrow a government or just change a local zoning rule. Phil Howard is a professor of communications at the University of Washington. Recently, he studied more than 1,200 examples of digital activism. I started by asking him, how do activists use social media and technology differently than, say, advertisers or corporations?
That's a great question, because a lot of the most recent examples of digital activism, especially in this country, are actually projects that were started by lobbyists. And it's actually tough for the average citizen to tell the difference between what we call an AstroTurf campaign, a campaign that's actually got APCO behind it.
Or fake grassroots.
Fake grassroots, exactly. And some of them look very real, but they're designed by folks on K Street in Washington, D.C., and they're designed specifically to get Americans to sign up and move a particular senator or congressman on their vote. Those are different from the grassroots campaigns.
That's not the kind of activism you're looking at, though, right? A fake activism.
Well, in our research sample, we captured those examples too. Uh-huh. It turns out that they're not necessarily more successful. So one of the things we've noticed in a big picture way is that the digital activism that really does come from the grassroots tends to be much more creative. It tends to be much more engaging. Sometimes it looks a little cheap compared to the fancier websites, but they have a more compelling message.
And maybe that's part of why people like them. Maybe cheap or amateurish looks authentic.
Local as well. Mm-hmm. That's a really big factor. If there's a problem that can be presented with photos and imagery of somebody who's been tormented by the security services or denied justice in some way, that really compelling story is what draws people.
Phil Howard is talking to us about his extensive research into digital activism at the Digital Activism Research Project. One of your conclusions is that digital campaigns are nonviolent. And I got to say, that surprised me, because we've heard a lot about neo-Nazi websites, jihadist websites, rabidly anti-Semitic websites that advocate violence. Mm-hmm. Why do you conclude that these are nonviolent?
It turns out that those are a small number of the total population of digital activism campaigns out there. And it also turns out that a lot of those most radical websites are increasingly marginalized around the world. There's fewer and fewer people participating in those kinds of movements because in a lot of countries, the mainstream parties, the parties that participate in elections, say, draw in more youth. They use Twitter. They use mobile phones. They're much more engaging. They're more moderate in their political views, and they actually attract people more.
Hmm. How do you get to the facts, though, on some of these shadowy websites that probably don't want to operate in completely open ways, because mm-hmm. of legalities, et cetera, or public condemnation for a neo-Nazi site, for example?
So the security services in this country have actually been very good at shutting down those kinds of websites. So when radicalism appears online with videos, anti-American content, or very radical views, those sites get pulled down fairly quickly because of the ability of security services in the West to track them and knock them down. It turns out that many of those organizations aren't interested in participating in electoral politics. And most of the sites that we studied, most of the Twitter campaigns, the Facebook campaigns, actually involve average citizens with modest goals. They don't all want to overturn the government. They just want more voice.
I just remember those jihadist websites that would show them executing a person on camera, and they would put that up for people to watch. Are you saying those are largely shut down now?
There's fewer and fewer of those, and it's harder and harder to find that kind of content. The one kind of exception for that kind of gory content is the videos that are taken during protests. So YouTube, for example, went through this interesting moment during the Arab Spring where they had to decide whether the videos coming out of Iran and Egypt were gore and should be taken off YouTube, or whether there was a public service value to having them on. And they decided that these videos were authentic, likely reliable evidence about what was going on in the streets of Tehran and Cairo, and they decided to keep them up.
That's so interesting, because it really makes us realize how important the policies of YouTube are to any kind of digital activism. They could have made another decision. They
Absolutely.
Could have said, this is too grotesque.
Yeah. And prior to the summer 2009 protests in Iran, YouTube had no editorial team. There was no need for YouTube to make editorial judgments about what content was going online. But when some of the videos showed up with young girls shot in the streets, they had to make a decision about what to keep up and what to take down.
What are your other conclusions in this extensive study? 48% of digital campaigns also use offline methods. Now, that's a real interesting formulation. Is that to say that they were primarily digital campaigns that included a real-life component to them?
I think one of the messages in our findings is that it no longer makes sense to make that distinction because offline activism that has no digital component may not go as far as the rival campaign that's got a sophisticated listserv and is able to use Twitter. The campaigns that are multimedia seem to be the ones that are most successful.
Well, that made me wonder. 48% of digital campaigns use offline methods. If you flip that around, do you have any idea how many activist campaigns don't use online methods at all, are strictly offline?
We do know about those campaigns, and those campaigns are mostly in authoritarian regimes, where just meeting in the streets in groups of three or four people is not legal.
There are so many activist causes with so many different goals, and as you pointed out, on so many different scales. How do you ever draw conclusions about how they're all working because they're so different?
They are so different, but we got to make when we study this kind of thing, we got to make some decisions about how to organize the evidence. And so our first step was to figure out which campaigns target government, which ones target businesses, firms, which ones target other civic campaigns, other civic groups. And it turns out that the activist campaigns that try to target government tend to be most successful. The ones that try to get change businesses to change their behavior tend not to be so successful.
Why do you suppose that is?
I think it's because most governments are designed to be at least a little bit responsive. They don't always want to respond affirmatively, and they don't always listen well. But most governments, even the ones that are authoritarian, want some feedback from the citizenry so they can figure out where to spend the public money. Firms, on the other hand, when you try to make a claim against a firm, they hire lobbyists, right? Their response strategy is different. They might redesign their product or stop polluting or whatever the example is. But part of a corporate response strategy involves hiring a PR specialist to help with the reaction. Governments tend not to have PR specialists in the same do the same thing mm-hmm. that firms do.
What about digital activism still puzzles you? What are the kind of the unanswered questions that you'd like to look at perhaps in your next round of research?
One of the things we've noticed is that regimes tend to catch up. There's always a period of a couple of months where an authoritarian regime doesn't fully understand what the activists are doing online, but eventually they figure it out and they figure out ways to censor or surveil what's going on. Activists, however, tend to be more desperate and more creative than most governments, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about what it is that drives that creativity, that innovation online. In some ways, some of these projects that people do online are incredibly innovative, and understanding that process of activist democracy innovation is what's interesting for me.
Do you have any hypotheses on why they might be so creative?
I think it's a compelling storyline. It's the personal story that draws anyone into activism. It's some injustice or some suffering from the past or that a friend or a family member has gone through that drives people forward.
That's Philip Howard. He's one of the leaders of the Digital Activism Research Project. It's at the University of Washington. This is The Record on KUOW.